And welcome back, everybody. We have been talking with Lloyd Pye and Brian Forrester about their upcoming tour in Peru and Bolivia, about the elongated skulls, human origins, megalithic sites, and a lot of the mysterious and interesting phenomena, of course, in the southern hemisphere. And we're going to bring in our third guest here in the second hour. We have Jerry Wills with us as well, joining us. Thank you for coming on, Jerry. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me on. I really appreciate it.
Oh, you bet. You're a first-time guest on the show here, of course. So why don't we just talk a little bit about the work you've been doing? You're working together with Kathy Wills, your wife, I believe, and you guys have a team. You're doing episodes also from South America. So just give our audience a little bit of an idea of what the work you're doing.
Sure. Well, it started back about 2005, I think it was. We had been making videos of the trips that we were making down here. We had organized tours that we were bringing folks down. Had been doing this since actually the late 80s. Had met a lot of very interesting people, been told a lot of very fascinating details about things that aren't normally on the tourist track. And we started making videos. By 2006, we launched Expeditions TV, basically because we wanted to show folks what we were seeing. We would tell folks about these things, but seeing it in video is a lot more interesting than just showing some pictures. Since that time, we've made it pretty much half of what our life is, to come down here frequently, look for strange and unusual things, and go after them with the video camera, and produce our own short documentaries. We had been told that Discovery or Nat Geo might be interested, but after putting about 15 different episodes together, it turns out they weren't, so we decided we'd make our own Discovery Channel, which turned out to be Expeditions TV. Now it's available online, expeditions.tv, and everything there is free for people to watch. There's no charge to watch anything. We do have a member section, and in that member section, people can download complete videos, and in the next coming months, we'll have it so that they can download the DVD files and burn their own DVDs of these things if they like. Basically, what we are doing is trying to find evidence of a forgotten past. Very much like Brian and Lloyd, there are elements of things out there that don't jive with what the archaeologists and what science tells us, what history tells us. As a result, we're trying to find the answers. And a lot of times these answers are very surprising, and they lead us in directions we hadn't even thought of looking, much like this journey we're on right now. We're following some leads at this time that have taken us on a few dashes left and a few dashes right of what we had thought we were going to be doing. Because the story leads us in these places, and some of these places are at times dangerous and quite often very remote. So that's what we're doing. We're trying to bring this information forward, trying to be unbiased as best we can, trying to have some fun as often as we can, and bring the information so that it will add to what's known.
Well, indeed, there's some
that's
great...
us.
Definitely, there's some great episodes up there, and I wanted to ask you about some of these, but I saw a recent one on the Aramu Muru site, pretty much, and you guys kind of refer to it as, I guess it's a Stargate, pretty much. It's down in Peru. Tell us a little bit about that, Jerry.
Well, that's a very, very strange place. Aramu Muru, it is a site. Yeah, it's down near Lake Titicaca in southern Peru. We'll be going by there the next 36 hours, actually, paying another visit. I'd met a fellow named Pedro. He was a shaman, an Aymara shaman. I didn't know him from anyone, really, but as it turned out, he was a master from the Titicaca area. He was actually teaching younger men the tradition. He and I became good friends, and after a few years... I started asking questions about this place because I had been shown Aramu Muru and had gone there. He eventually opened up more and more to me about it. And finally, he gave me some information that I thought was pretty fantastic, but I thought I'd give it a try anyway. It had to do with using tones that he had been privileged to receive from the people that go in and out of the doorway, as he put it. Well, I mean, these are great stories, but I really wasn't sure it was truthful. It was just a great story. But he gave me these tones, and I went there, about 2001, I think. It was earlier than that. It was like 1998. And I tried the tones. Well, what happened was this gateway, this doorway, whatever you might want to consider it as, it became active. And when it became active, a lot of very strange things started happening. Since then, I've been back there numerous times. I've used the tones a few times to see if it would still work. And in that video you're referring to, there's one point where I'm sitting there talking about the tones, sitting in the doorway. And if you watch carefully, you'll see that the color starts to change on the camera. The phase shift of chrominance, it starts to change the hue, basically. And there's some when you're there, it's a very strange feeling because it feels as though you have waves of energy rocking you back and forth. When we saw this, we didn't see this strange aberration in the video until we'd gotten back home, several weeks later. And I had thought that maybe there was something wrong with the camera and all the video that we'd shot was now going to be screwed up. But as it turns out, that's the only place in numerous tapes that there was anything like this that occurred. In talking with Dr. Michio Kaku, it was one of those things he suggested, maybe if this energy is so powerful, it was causing this time dilation, this color shift. And there's a lot of speculation what could have caused it. We don't know. But it was definitely one of those events that got caught on camera that's unexplainable. The history of this place, from what I was told, is that there are people from other worlds or other dimensions, don't know which, that come through this doorway at times. They exit the doorway and then at some other point in time, hours later, days later perhaps, they show up and they go back into the doorway again, kneeling before it. And there's a soft glowing light surrounding them, and then they're gone. For my experience, it was a bit scary. I was there with a number of other folks. My wife at the time, my wife Kathy was there at the time, and what they saw was a soft glowing light that surrounded me, and then I was gone. I was only gone for about a minute or so, and then I returned. But for me, it was as though I was gone for hours. I had lost track of time. It was a very, very frightening experience, and certainly not one that I would want to do again, because I have no idea how this thing works. So I pretty much avoid it. Huh. At least trying to turn it on. I'm still trying to figure out the mechanics of it, how it operates. I just haven't got a clue.
Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the experience. Of course, let's just describe it a little bit for our audience that haven't seen it before. When I looked at some of the pictures of it, and it looks it's a symbolic doorway in the sense that it's carved into the bedrock, but the way, not the style perhaps, but the way it's carved remind me a little bit of Petra in Jordan or something like that. This huge cliff wall, and it's carved into it. I don't know what it's supposed to represent, if it's a big portal and then you have a smaller one in the center, or you could explain it to us, Jerry, of what we're looking at there.
Well, it's just as you're describing it. It's similar to Petra. It's not as elaborate as Petra, of course. But, it's an upthrust of petrified sandstone, thousands, hundreds of thousands of years old, maybe millions of years old. I don't know. And on this this shelf of sandstone that otherwise would be quite irregular, it has been smoothed off in a nice square fashion. There are two indentations on either side that are inverted columns. In other words, they go in. In the center, there's a keyhole-like doorway with a small depression in the center. And if you stand back away from this this feature, from this upthrust of sandstone, you see that what looks to be, for the world, like a woman lying on her back. Now, the King Midas's tomb, I've forgotten where that's at. Exactly. It's in Europe. Is very similar to this, and there are also very similar doorways like this that have been found in Egypt as well. And it's a common thing in various parts of the world. I'm, of course, curious whether these other places, like King Midas's tomb and the ones in Egypt, if these were also made of sandstone, and if so, if they were on ley lines, such as the doorway at Aramamuru is, and if they might have been used in the same manner as Aramamuru. There's a lot of questions. Because we found that this actually is a working portal of some sort, we've been looking for others, and we found a few that apparently are still functional. Very, very difficult to get to. And in fact, Aramamuru used to be very difficult to get to before the road was improved and communities started springing up around it. Mm-hmm. And we're finding ways are in quite remote locations. So, you know, I'm sure there must be several.
Interesting. Yeah, I think the tomb you're referring to, I think it's in Turkey, the tomb you're referring to. I wanted to ask you, Brian, if you've have you been down there yet?
Oh, yeah, I've been to Aramamuru 10 times, I would guess.
Wow.
And it's, it's, yeah, compared to anything else you see in the area, there are famous other sites nearby, relatively nearby, like Silistani, and Tiwanaku's not too far away. But Aramamuru, some people call it Amarumuru, is very unique, and that's what's so striking. And when you first cast your eyes on it, it's such an otherworldly thing. I know that it's a becoming much more popular now than it has been in the past. Like as Jerry said, there's quite a good road that is close to it, but it's very enigmatic. The red sandstone is very high in iron, so it could be highly electromagnetic. It's a very intriguing place.
Yeah, it certainly looks like a lot of things are around Lake Titicaca, Jerry. That seems to be a high point in itself. And I've seen programs about you know, this being a very ancient place and relationships to it. But as you travel around the lake and such, are there like a lot of these different sites around in that area?
Well, we've gone around Lake Titicaca looking for things like this. And yeah, we've found some very old and ancient places. Nothing like Aramamuru. You know, I think there's a direct connection between there and Tiwanaku. I couldn't say for sure there is, but it certainly seems that there is. One of the things that is truly enigmatic about it was something we discovered a few years ago. We had just finished work on our video for Markawasi, which is just outside of Lima for several hours. Markawasi is strewn with all kinds of figures in stone, faces and heads and animals and so forth. It's fascinating. It's way up on top of this plateau, about 13,000 foot tall plateau. Anyway, we'd been going there for years and years, long before anyone ever thought about going there, you know, in a tourist industry. We had climbed to the top of Aramamuru to do some video from up there and discovered that some of our equipment was failing. Watches stopped, batteries were just dead, that otherwise should have been just fine. Looking around, we discovered what looked like some of the same features as we had been seeing at Markawasi, immediately behind the upthrust of sandstone. We started investigating this. No one's ever mentioned it before, and no one has ever really made any videos about it before, so we went ahead and got new batteries, got things charged, and started shooting video from up above it as well. And on that video, we do capture some of those images. One's like a tarantula, another's a bird. The fascinating thing to me was when you get really back far away and to the right of the doorway, you start seeing even larger details, like, for example, a sperm whale or other figures, oceanic figures that were in that patina of the sandstone. It's just absolutely amazing. And of course, nearby here, there is a place called Ilave. And Ilave, a small community just south of the doorway at Aramamuru. And it's the whole area is covered with walls, small walls, you know, chest high. They don't seem to have any rhyme or reason, and there aren't really any entrances or exits. There's just walls, all kinds of walls and all kinds of shapes. They cover the landscape. And it's in this area that we started finding some other very strange strange things, you know, patterns that were only visible from the air. You know, it makes you wonder who would go to that much trouble at that elevation.
Tell us about the strange patterns that you were seeing.
Well, these patterns are created within the walls of the stonework at Ilave. To look at it from, you know, the standard level, we're just walking around looking at these things. There are no doorways, no entrances or exits. They're just walls of varying sizes. But it's when you get high above, even to the point of satellite photography, that you start noticing patterns within this landscape. It's just a very strange place. And the point is that from, let's say, the doorway at Aramamuru, going south through Ilave, and then down towards Tiwanaku, Pumapunku, and beyond, you have a lot of very strange features on the Earth's surface that don't make any sense at all. Why would they be made if they can't be recognized from the ground? You know, much like the Nazca lines, the Palpa lines. And who would go to that much trouble to cover really thousands of acres of land over hills, on top of hills, and in valleys with varying sizes of stone walls? Some are very narrow and long, and others are quite broad. But why would they do such a thing? And it's part of the great mystery for this place. There's just things that don't make sense, and yet they exist.
Any suggestions on how old some of these carvings and some, you know, how old is the doorway in Muru there?
Well, we really don't have any idea. I don't know that anyone really knows. My guess is that it was there before the Great Flood. And, you know, I think that the lake was, Lake Titicaca was actually very near it. I think the way you got to this thing was by boat originally. But as far as how old, that's anybody's guess. That's, you know, 12,000, 20,000, 50,000 years old. I mean, it's very, very ancient. You know, it's like when you take a look at the technology of things, how the people made the blocks for the pyramids, or the stones for Sacsayhuaman or Ollantaytambo. You know, these things are all quite great mysteries because the technology that was used has been lost, forgotten, or else someone has secreted it away, and it's never going to be found in our lifetimes, I'm sure. But it still remains a mystery. And how old is it? God only knows. it's just impossible to guess.
Brian, do you have any suggestions on this? Is there anything that you've seen that has similarities to some of the stonework that you've examined? What I'm trying to get to is, should we attribute this to one and the same culture, or as usual, we're probably talking about a multitude of cultures, inspiration from each other. There are subtle variations, perhaps. What do you think, Brian?
Well, actually, Jerry brought up a very good point, and that's that there are quite a few strange ancient megalithic sites around Lake Titicaca. But physically, you have to be at Lake Titicaca to see the extent of the floodplain, which is the flat area around Lake Titicaca. And supposedly around 10,000 years ago, the lake level was about 100 feet higher than it is now. And so at that time, more or less 10,000, maybe 12,000 years ago, then at that time, Aramumuru and also Tiwanaku Pumapunku and also this site called Silustani, they would have all been right at the shore of the lake. And so as Jerry was saying, that is how you would have maneuvered from one spot to another. Lake Titicaca would have been much larger in size. And with any great ancient civilization or even modern civilization, water is the most fundamental thing there is. So any great culture always develops around an abundance of fresh water. And Lake Titicaca, I believe, is the second largest lake in South America. Or if nothing else, it's the highest navigable lake. It's quite massive in size. And that's why it's such a mysterious place, because you have this ancient lake, these very strange structures that conventional archaeology can't explain. And even in the case of Aramumuru, the local people don't even seem to know what it's called. A lot of them call it the Devil's Doorway.
Hmm. Yeah, and of course, you know why they call it that, right, Brian? Because of the stories of people disappearing into it.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
So what's going on here? What did you manage to, what did you experience, Jerry, when you were gone for? You said several hours, but it was a minute for the onlookers?
Yeah, it was about a minute, maybe 2 minutes. It was just, it was very, very odd. It was extraordinarily disorienting. When you're dreaming and you feel like you're falling in a dream? That's how it felt. And that's how it feels when the doorway turns on and you're kneeling there in front of it. When it starts working, that's one of the first sensations that most everyone will feel, as though you're falling. It gets much more intense when it goes full on. What I experienced was just whisking through space. It just felt like I was traveling through the cosmos. It wasn't as elaborate and movie-esque as Stargate SG-1, the long tunnel luminous with planets and nova flashing by.
Right.
Instead, it was just dark with stars here and there, and just the sense of moving at such an incredible speed that it was impossible to calculate what was really happening.
Did you actually go anywhere, or did you just later kind of get traveled back again, like it was a loop and then you were out of it, or how did that happen?
Well, it's a bit of a complicated story, really. I essentially arrived at a location, and while I was there, there was someone there, people there, obviously, because it was some kind of facility, and they wanted to let me know I was fine. They were surprised someone had actually arrived there, but it had happened a few times in the past. And they basically never let me see them, never heard them except through a speaker. And they wanted to know about me, what I was doing, and I wanted to know about them and what was this place. Eventually, they said that what they had been doing was experimenting with a type of device that was accelerating, it was like an accelerator, like the thing, CERN in Europe, the reactor, the you know, what is it, the CERN collider?
The Large Hadron Collider.
Yeah, that's it. At the time, there was no such thing as that. I didn't know anything about it, but they described something that sounds now just like that. They were trying to understand the layers of the universe. They wanted to know where they came from, and in order to do that, they had to create something that would create a version of the universe for them to be able to understand where they had come from and what existed beyond what they could see. And apparently, they had successfully created something, and that's what I had just come out of. With that, I noticed how I couldn't tell the duration of time I'd been gone. And I became actually quite worried about it because I knew Kathy was there sitting in the dark, as were the other people, and you know what was going to happen if I was gone for a long time. You know, a lot of these questions were just plaguing me. So eventually I made it a point that I had to get back, and they showed me how to go back into this, and I ended up coming back only a minute or so after I'd left. It sounds like a fantastic story, and maybe it was all a dream. I don't know.
Did other onlookers actually see you disappear, or was it a mental travel, a spirit travel that you did?
No, that's what alarmed Kathy and the others, is that I just wasn't there any longer.
And then you came back out of it.
Yeah, and then there was another glow, and suddenly I was back there in front of the doorway again.
Hmm. Well, it's quite an extraordinary experience. It's a program entirely in itself, of course, and maybe we should do that, spend some more time on analyzing that. I just wanted to bring Lloyd into this a little bit as well here, so we don't leave you out, Lloyd, because regarding the whole, ET question, we in the first hour we talked quite a bit about basically mankind, the origins of mankind, and the possibility of us being manipulated genetically to become what we are today. Do you think that anything in terms of what they would either inspire or their work themselves would leave something like this behind for us to find out or to even discover? Could we be talking about the same genetic manipulators here, basically, Lloyd?
Well, we're talking about obviously someone, but I don't think that they would necessarily leave something like that behind, sort of as a lesson or a pathway or anything. It could just be accidental, or they just, like the pyramids or anything else, they just got, they were done here, and that was part of what they used to maybe get here or leave here or whatever. But I would just say this in general, as a general comment to any story like what we've just heard from Jerry, I believe that right now, as we all sit here and talk and think and live and exist, we are, as profoundly ignorant of real true reality as were the people 500 years ago who believed that the Earth was both flat and the center of the universe. And 500 years ago, that was all they had. And we look back at that and we think, wow, how colossally ignorant. But nonetheless, the reality of it is that today, while we think we're so much more advanced than they are, relative to the end zone, relative to where we have to go, relative to the amount of work that we have to do to get where they are, where those kind of people are, we're that ignorant. We're that profoundly behind the curve. And so these things that we see around us that they might have left on Earth, that they did leave on Earth, what they do is they tell us clearly how ignorant we are. But because of our ego situation, particularly those of us with PhD after our names, we are unable to acknowledge that ignorance in a comfortable way and just say, well, yeah, we really don't know. That part of the search has always been left to people like Jerry, like Brian, like me, like you. Those of us who are outside the system and therefore have the ability to say, I don't know, I want to find out. I mean, you hear as we all talk, we're all seeking the truth. We're not seeking to support a paradigm that is obviously bankrupt and stupid. We're looking for the truth. But as it was 500 years ago, when the leaders of the church were sitting in the power chairs and they were fighting desperately to keep their purchase on the power chairs intact so that they didn't have to deal with change, with profound change. That's exactly how things are now, 500 years later, with mainstream scientists sitting in those same power chairs that they usurped from the religious leaders who were sitting in the power chairs 500 years ago. Yeah. And now they are just as desperate to hold on to their purchase on those power chairs and to fight against any dramatic upheaval or change as were the people that they fought to overturn 500 years ago, or that their ancestors did. And so nothing's changed. Nothing's changed. It's all the same. We know more, but we don't know nearly enough to explain all these things around us and to provide an understanding of the reality that those beings that were here before, that they lived with. And we're just chipping away at it. People like us, we're chipping away as best we can in our own allotted lifetimes, and people will come behind us the way people came behind Copernicus and Galileo and Kepler and those guys to figure out the truth of the flat earth center of the universe thing. And we will be part of the formula of arriving at the real truth for our generations to come. And then there will be probably more truths laid on top of what they do. It's an unending thing, but what the mainstream tries to project is that they're on top of everything, and there's, you know, almost everything, almost all but the loose ends are wrapped up and all that. Ridiculous, just absolutely ridiculous. And stories like what Jerry experienced, I think, give insight into that.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, on top of that, we're trying to understand if we are simply talking about previous high cultures that have existed on the planet. It might be mankind still within a different configuration. There might be other visitor here. There might be beings that we just, you know, can't explain that actually have a technology of sorts, because that's how I would describe this. As you're talking about this, Jerry, it feels like a kind of an ancient device or something, a technology basically. And so in hindsight, any ideas of whom you were encountering or to, you know, whom this technology belongs?
I think that it was probably a parallel existence. It wasn't like I was on another planet, but maybe I was. You know, it was such a strange situation. I don't know where I was, honestly, but they spoke English. They seemed to be able to communicate with me quite effectively. It felt like it was a parallel universe, and me getting there was incorporated through this doorway somehow. And even now, I mean, I could take anyone out there, give you the tones. You can try it for yourself and see what happens. I've done that. Of course, in that video that you referred to, I did this with four or five guys and had them give it a try, and they each had their own very unique and different experiences. So, I don't know.
Yeah. No, the most, I think, the most strange thing, if you will, that I've experienced has to be the Brown Mountain Lights, and I'm still to this day convinced that it's something to do with the, and it doesn't mean that it's not opening up something or you know, quote unquote channeling energy or whatnot, but you know, it's some kind of electrical effect that happens, you know, probably with the geology, and as so many times we see this connected with stonework, with mountains or caverns, or you know, carvings in rock, or placing, you know, different types of rock on top of each other. It seems to have some kind of interactive effect on the human, well, both body, but also primarily actually on the consciousness, on our consciousness. So I wanted to, with that in mind, I wanted to ask you, Brian, as you've been traveling around to a lot of these sites and everything else in Peru, Bolivia, and all that stuff, have you ever had any similar experience, something strange or unexplained happen to you?
Not as dramatic as Jerry's, but definitely when you're at sites like Aramumuru and Pumapunku and Tiwanaku and Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo, etc., I think you naturally go into an alternate state of consciousness, partially because of the fact that whoever these ancient builders were, they knew what type of stone they wanted to use. In the case of Aramumuru, it happens that the bedrock in that specific area is high in iron oxide. It has electrical properties. But in the case of the other sites, and including in Egypt, these ancient builders specifically wanted high iron or even more often high quartz content. And so that's why they would select and move, you know, multi-ton blocks from great distances of granite and andesite, basalt and other materials, because they wanted that electrical property for whatever function it was that they were doing. And in the case of Cusco, where I'm at presently, I think that the original builders of ancient Cusco, thousands of years before the Inca, were building pragmatic, functioning, energetic structures for some reason that is beyond our comprehension.
Yeah. Yeah, it's fascinating. And Jerry, you guys have a lot of course, episodes on this around your on your website, where people can look more about this around in these areas that we're talking about. Is there anything else that stands out to you and things that really have been like a highlight when you've been doing these episodes?
You know, the things that have really been extraordinary for us is when we get a chance to really get close with the folks in the area on some of these more remote places, and we are then told some of the stories or legends surrounding the things that they find fascinating or mysterious. It was an example of that was when we were in Tekachi, both 13 years ago and just recently. The Tekachi's are a very dangerous place to go. And both times we've been told about UFOs that they've seen that have come down out of the mountains, very large craft that just hover over the mountains. And the people that they see that are associated with this incident, you know, there are truly some amazing stories out there that never make the light of day. And that's basically what we're going after. We're looking to bring those forward.
Is South America richer with these kinds of observations? In your view, I reckon you're born in America, I guess, and is it just more in Southern America?
Well, yeah, I'm from the United States, and you know, I think it's because this is kind of like the Wild West. There are such vast regions of unexplored, uninhabited, isolated communities. It is hundreds of years behind the United States as far as connectivity goes. Roads to get there, so few people. So yeah, it's like the Wild West. And I think that's the reason why we find so much stuff down here. And plus, you know, because there's so few people, there's not a lot of high technology or high improvement that you would find in the United States. So you don't have bulldozers all over the place. You don't have people digging stuff up. Things down here are very difficult to get to in most instances. Tiwanaku used to be very difficult to get to. I came down here when it wasn't easy. Same with Machu Picchu. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's that sort of thing that makes South America so appealing. No one's really screwed it up yet. But there are great stories. I mean, we have friends all over the world. We get stories everywhere from Asia to Australia to, you know, all over East and Western Europe, and invitations to come and explore and document really very odd things. So I know there are stories everywhere. It just happens to be that, you know, we kind of focused on this for the time being. You know, in the years to come, we're probably going to expand that to a more global view, actually.
Well, it's a lot to handle. You know, I remember that watching just what was that called again? Long Way Around. Was actually this motorcycle. It was Ewan McGregor and his friend traveling around the world.
Charlie,
you know, camera crews and everything with them, and just just the bureaucracy alone, I don't know, I don't want to go too much off topic, but I'm saying that these kinds of expeditions that you're involved in and taking those to other countries and everything else, geez, you know, that in that way, then you really appreciate the ruralness and the fact that there isn't like maybe a lot of difficult, well, I'm not saying that there aren't difficult borders in South America, but if it's more rural, you could travel around maybe a little bit more freely, although it's more difficult, but just handling that, you know, the circumstantial stuff in doing an episode from different parts of the world, that's a lot of work. There's a lot of things to do. A lot of planning goes into that.
Well, it's just Kathy and I, so it isn't like there's a crew that has to accompany us.
Right.
So, yeah, we went to Athens in Bulgaria a few months ago, interviewed Dr. Lachesar Filipov, and did some work researching giants under Athens, which we haven't released yet. And, you know, sure, I mean, it's a lot of work to get there. It certainly isn't cheap. It becomes monumentally expensive. But, you know, you get there, you go to what you're going to do. And for us now, we have people all over the world who know about us, that like us, that want to help, want to contribute. And it makes it a lot easier for us now to go to these places.
Well, exactly. That's the way it works. And I mean, that's the same way what you guys are doing. You're documenting, Brian and Lloyd, you're documenting your travels. And of course, I know that you as well, Lloyd, has been involved in trying to raise funds to get the DNA work done on the skull and everything else. So that's, you know, that's what happens at the end of the day, obviously, because there needs to be resources to get some of this these things done. But the encouraging part of all this, though, I think there's an increasing audience to all of this. There's an increasing interest in these kinds of topics, and people want to know about the mysteries of the world, and that includes the Star Child skull and everything that that's connected to, Lloyd. So,
for me, yeah, the thing about it is, as we mentioned briefly earlier, the mainstream has access, which they very carefully control and protect. They have access to actual funding money, to grant money that is, you know, is in the massive millions of dollars. And people feel like when they give money to that, they're giving it to legitimate research just because the people who are involved are mainstream people. And the mainstream does everything they can to make it seem like that anybody giving money to anyone not in the mainstream is just flushing it down the toilet, which is not true. But it keeps us from being able to do the kind of work that we could do to upend their paradigms. So if for them, it's a very important thing to keep us looking fringe, ignorant, stupid, everything we say is wrong, you know, that sort of thing. And it keeps us from having access to the formal piles of money that they hoard and dip into every way they can, as often as they can. So it's just a grunt fight for the money, and it leaves us very much on the short end of the stick, and so it's hard. But as you say, hopefully things are increasing. But I've been doing it now for years with the Star Child, and I can tell you, and you guys know too, because you have the same problem I do, the amount of money that we can go after is infinitesimally small relative to the amount of money that any mainstream researcher can go after.
Well, that's why it's so ridiculous when people, you know, charge for their work or try to, you know, make this to go around, basically, to continue to do the research and the work. And just as you said, Lloyd, instead you have these, you know, immensely powerful organizations that are just, you know, pouring it down the drain and nothing happens. And then you have people struggling and trying to make ends meet and really, you know, dig into and sure look at the alternatives to this, but nonetheless in that process offer a really excellent alternative and something completely different than what the mainstream is offering. And still there seems to be a point of, you know, complaint or whatever on that. So that's the negative side to all this. But I think it's just about keeping doing, you know, the work and what can be done with the resources that's available, because I think at the end of the day, that the primary drive is the interest and the you know, answers and the search for the answers. That's the driving force, and the money is a side issue to just make that happen, basically. So I think
it's a lot of it is spreading the word, and
yes,
what you do at Red Ice is really an important part of that. letting, you know, letting more and more people know, because there is a ripple effect. And when something good comes along, especially with the new social media and all that, you can, you know, the word can spread. So we're all looking for ways to improve our internet presence and get the word out. And we all, you know, we're always asking each other, help get the word out, help spread the word. Same thing with this tour that we're doing in August. Brian and I, we have to get the word spread out about that. And there are still seats available for those who might be interested. And we would hope that people would join us, because they're going to come away from that experience with something that they will be able to treasure always.
That's right. Very, very good point. I wanted to return to you a little bit more, Jerry, and ask you about either if there's something, you know, upcoming episodes that you would like to talk a little bit about, or just basically spend some more time on some of the work that you guys are doing there, and so we can make sure we convey what you have to offer and the work that you're doing.
Oh, thanks. You know, basically what we're doing right now is we're following three stories. We already have two in the can. One is the Doomsday Stone, which we shot up the Tecachi River a few weeks ago. This is a stone that's on top of a mountain. It was buried, actually, in dirt. We were shown part of it, so they dug it out, showed us the rest of it, and it tells a story of waves going over the Andes. It's quite an extraordinary thing to see. So we've gone there. We filmed this now. The second story was called Cumbamayo Sacred Water. It's part two. And we've gotten the second part of that, showing the tunnels into the Andes. The third, fourth, and fifth stories that we're working on, they are sort of converging. We have a series of events that took place starting back with the fall of Troy and the Trojan Wars. And it moves forward in time, and it involves several different cultures. And it brings us to the, to the Bolivian shore, not Bolivian, but the Chilean and Peruvian shores of the Pacific, all the way across through Brazil, all the way back to Europe. It's what we're uncovering right now is breathtaking. It's just really mind-boggling, the things that we found. And we're still trying to piece it all together. And as a result, we're leaving tomorrow, heading towards La Paz. We've got to go down there and meet with some scholars and take a look at some evidence and collect some samples and so forth. Because what it looks like is we have found a connection between Tecachi and the Doomsday Stone and events at Puapunku and Tiwanaku, and something that wiped out part of the world in ancient times. So it's like a mind-boggling story, and that's what we're involved with at the moment.
You mentioned something earlier, Jimmy, about the various different cultures, the Templars, the Phoenicians, the Venetians, and even the Vikings, I think you dragged into that. As we've been detailing on this program before, we talk about transcultural diffusion, basically, you know, that we have a lot of ancient cultures were involved in seafaring. And as we know, the Vikings went over to Vinland in, you know, North America. Is it in that kind of style that there's a connection where some of these ancient cultures traveled, Jerry?
Yeah, I think so. Because we've already found evidence of Vikings in South America. And we've also found evidence of a few other cultures here that no one ever dreamed were here. How did they know to come here? What are these roads? What are these maps? What are these things that we're finding? Is it scattered pieces that we've started assembling together that are just fantastic? And as it turns out, there was a more sophisticated world before the flood, and that world was in touch. People were in touch with each other all over the world. It wasn't like isolated communities of Neanderthals. Instead, they were exchanging ideas, philosophies, and concepts, and goods and materials. People were going like they're going now, here and there, and deciding to uproot and live somewhere else. well, we're finding that evidence. And, you know, it, of course, in a very general sense, that's fascinating in itself. But what we have found is, in very specific terms, some things that we never dreamed that we would be coming across. And I can't really talk about what those things are right now. But once I get a timeline in place and I get all the details in place, then I'll be very comfortable talking about it. It's just I don't want to make any mistakes, because mistakes make you look foolish.
Sure, no worries about that. Well, give us your website, Jerry, so people know where to go. I mean, I would suggest maybe having you and Kathy back on the program and just, you know, dedicate more time to, you know, talking about either some of the past episodes or whatever you guys have upcoming in the pipeline, if you'd be interested in that. As this is just a, you know, we're just scratching the surface, very peripheral here, but nonetheless, we want to kind of give a heads up to our folks out there. But give us the website, Jerry, so people know where to go again.
Yeah, of course. And thanks for the invite. We'd be happy to take you up on it. The website is, the word is expeditions. Like, we're going on two expeditions next week. Drop the E. It's just expeditions.tv. So it's expeditions.tv. Our fellow, our good friend, John Shooter at Coastal Computing in Spain, is in charge of our website. He designed it. It's a state-of-the-art system, and it just really rocks. We've got all of our videos up there now, and these new videos will be up there shortly.
All right, very good. We're going to say bye and thank you to you, Jerry. Yes, we do the same to Lloyd and Brian here. But yeah, we'll definitely stay in contact there and try to have you and Kathy or you back again at some point, talk some more about this, because you guys are doing some interesting work down there, and I'd love to talk more about it. So thank you for joining us this time for this 1 hour here, Jerry. We do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate you having us on.
Excellent. Expeditions.tv, that's the website. We'll have that linked up. And once more, guys, we'll return to both of you, and we'll just give you an opportunity to mention the website for the upcoming tour as well. And as you said, Lloyd, there's still seats available for guys who want to join you down in South America, Peru, and such. So give us out the details, and if there's anything else you guys have left out so far.
It's www.hiddeninkatours.com. And also, I have a website dedicated to videos of many of my explorations, and that's www.hiddeninkavideos.com.
Right, very good. Hiddeninkavideos.com, hiddeninkatours.com, and also Gary's. Check out Gary's. We'll link that up, infinite-connections.co.uk. And then, of course, LloydPie.com for that work. And then you have, give us the Starchild Skull address again.
www.starchildproject, all one word, starchildproject.com. And my name is spelled LLOYDPYE. It's easy to make that mistake. LloydPie.com.
All right, there we go. A lot of websites for you guys out there to check out, but we'll have it up on the website, of course. So just click through from there. All right, thank you to each and every one of you, Lloyd, Brian, and Jerry, for joining us. We really appreciate it. I wish you all the best down on your travels and adventures. So thank you to all of you.
Thank you, Henrik.
Thank you very much.
And we'll return in just a few days. We have some great programs coming up with Allison Adams, Penny Pierce, Robert G. Johnson, and Jane Weston. We also have Stephen Greer, and then Paolo Albergini, and Ibrahim Karim. Later we have Maurice Cottrell, and then Walter Block as well. You're welcome to tune in again whenever it suits you. You can stream or download the programs from the website redicecreations.com. We also have our archived programs in their entirety on Red Ice Members. .com. Please consider acquiring a membership, sign up, and get full access to all the good stuff that we produce. And at the same time, we're able to continue to bring you this program without commercial interruptions and an ad-free website. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I also want to extend my thanks to Frederick, Lana, and Elizabeth. Have a great day, folks, and we will talk to you later. Bye-bye.